right, good morning. So let me briefly, so we started discussing general relativity from the action principle perspective. And so we started with discussing the geodesic equation. And even there, if you noticed, then we have been using this principle of minimal coupling to gravity by saying, well, basically, we had to express our proper time of the particle moving, you know, in the space-time by replacing the flat Minkowski metric with the Kerf metric there in the action. And that's precisely what gave us, like, the generalized geodesic equation in Kerf space, right? In addition to this, if you see any partial derivatives in your special relativistic Lagrangian, you better replace them with the covariant derivatives. But you may also be, you may also have to do something else, but that something else is not dictated by this principle, right? So sometimes you just use these minimal changes to your Lagrangian, and then it turns out that the theory which you get is not a nice theory, or it's not what you would expect to be the right generalization to Kerf space. And eventually, it's the experiment which decides, like, is this the right thing or bad thing? So for example, if you discuss scalar field theory, so the special relativistic Lagrangian is just 1/2 partial phi square, right? But so if I generalize this to the Kerf space, I may want to add the square root of determinant in front of my measure, and I may want to replace the partial derivatives, the covariant derivatives. But there is one interesting change which you can do with the scalar field, is that you add a term proportional to the Ricci scalar. And if you find properly the coefficient standing in front of Ricci scalar, then you will get something which is called conformally coupled scalar field. And that's a very nice thing to have in Kerf space-time. So then you are not using this minimal coupling principle, but you are adding terms which are proportional to something like Riemann tensor and stuff like that, which, of course, you don't see in the flat space. Anyway, so this is the Lagrangian as we postulated. So we just, you know, upgraded the measure here by putting this thing here. So that is a scalar. So your Lagrangian density here better be scalar as well. So both of these things are scalars. And we get this guy here by simply replacing partial derivatives with covariant derivatives. And wherever I see the flat metric, the Kerf metric there, right? So now you can see that, well, in principle, you can treat, although it's a matter action, you can sort of also treat it as a functional of your metric, right? So I'm plugging eta to g, so I can also understand it as a function of metric, which is a strange thing to do, but we will use it over here. So first, it is a function of phi. So if you vary this with respect to phi, impose that that is equal to zero, you get your Euler-Lagrange equations of motion, which are exactly as those in special relativity, except you replace everywhere the partial derivatives with the covariant derivatives. So this is your equations of motion for the matter field phi. Okay, but we can also do this very strange thing. We can now vary the same action, but now with respect to the metric. Okay, and if you do that, well, you have to have a variation of the metric over here. And then whatever stands in front of that, you call the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so this is the definition of the energy momentum tensor. So now it's very easy to show that such energy momentum tensor is symmetric. Okay, so symmetric automatically. And why is that? Is that, of course, this guy here, delta g mu nu, has to be symmetric in mu and nu. So this guy here, even if it had antisymmetric part, then the antisymmetric part would be antisymmetric times symmetric would give me zero. So basically, this equation does not provide any information about the antisymmetric part of t mu nu. Okay? And so because I'm using it as a definition of t mu nu, it only makes sense to define t mu nu as a symmetric object. Okay? So t mu nu will be symmetric. But moreover, on shell, meaning when the equations of motion are satisfied, if this is true, then the statement is this thing here will be conserved in the sense of this equation here. That will be true, provided that really we have diffeomorphism invariant theories. Okay, so what is a diffeomorphism? Is it a coordinate transformation? So note, we have diffeomorphism invariant. So that's an invariance on the change of coordinates. And in other words, you know, it just says, well, this is a scalar, this is a scalar. So the whole thing is a scalar. It cannot change on the change of coordinates. Okay. So the whole thing is a scalar. So we have scalar. So the action does not change. Action invariant. And the change of coordinates. So now any coordinate transformation you can write infinitesimally. So this is infinitesimal. Infinitesimally. You can write as I'm changing my coordinates to x mu minus xi mu, where xi mu is a small vector. And this is not only a translation. If I consider the finite dimensional, well, finite transformation, then you know this would be just a translation. But because it's infinitesimal, it can be rotation, it can be anything, right? All I'm assuming is that my transformation is written as 1 plus a small perturbation. And then this is what you get. So xi mu is a function of x, of course. Right? So xi mu is a function of x here. It's a small vector field. And then, did you do the tutorial about the killing vectors already?
What's that?
Did you do the tutorial about killing vectors? No. So on Friday, Thursday, someday soon, you will show that if you do such a coordinate transformation, then you know how the components of the metric transform under coordinate transformation. Right? They transform as dx over dx prime, whatever, dx over dx prime times the original metric. Right? So if you plug this transformation there, you'll find that the components of the metric simply transform. Okay. We go from g mu nu to g mu nu plus 2 times blah, blah, mu psi nu symmetrized. And this is what you call delta g mu nu. Okay, so this is how the components of the metric change, just using your transformation rule, which you know how the tensors transform under coordinate transformation. So you just use that rule. This is what you get. Okay, so let's use these facts, right? So I'll repeat the calculation because it's just one line calculation, but it's very, very important for general relativity. So what I'm saying is that let's now do the full variation of this metric, of this matter action. And of course, that will be a variation with respect to the field plus variation with respect to the metric. Okay. So this is what you get. So now if you say that this variation is simply just a result of coordinate transformation, okay? So now you say, well, this is what all I've been doing is actually just a diffeomorphism. Then the action has to be invariant because it's scalar. Okay, so this has to be equal to zero if the variation is just just a diffeomorphism, just a change of coordinates. Everybody happy with this statement? So I start with a scale action. If I change coordinates, doesn't do anything. So the variation has to be equal to zero. Okay. So in that case, I have this plus that is equal to zero. So then I say, well, what if I'm on shell? Okay, if I'm on shell, meaning the equations of motion for the matter are satisfied, then this thing here has to be zero because that's how I define them. So this thing here will be equal to zero if on shell, meaning if the equations of motion for the matter are satisfied. So very good. So we have that 0 equals to 0 plus delta G Sm. But delta G of Sm was precisely my definition of the energy momentum tensor. So this is minus 1 half ddx square root of minus g t mu nu. And then, because it's a diffeomorphism, it's a variation induced by the change of coordinates, I can plug for my delta g mu nu precisely what the variation of the coordinates gives me, which is this expression over here. Okay. 2 times lambda mu psi nu symmetrized. Okay, now I can take the 2 out, so it will be just minus. And then, so this is equal to minus dd x square root of g. And then T mu nu, but T mu nu is by definition symmetric. Okay, what I am doing here is that I am symmetrizing over the index mu and nu. Okay, so again, any anti-symmetric part will not contribute, but because this is already symmetric, I can just remove the symmetrization there. So it's just nabla mu psi nu. Okay, so I just remove, because this guy is already symmetric, so the symmetrizing here doesn't do anything. So finally, you integrate by parts. You shift this derivative from here onto this object over there. And of course, you pick up a minus sign. So this is equal to ddx square root of g nabla mu. Let's write it this way. It's not very nice. But anyway, psi nu plus boundary term. Which comes from the integration by parts.
Sorry, Lenny.
Yes.
So up there, you use the fact that delta g mu nu is symmetric to say that t mu nu is symmetric. And over here, you said that because t mu nu is symmetric, then you can just use that symmetry.
Exactly.
So there, you made an assumption that since you're writing the metric, the variation has to be symmetric as well, right?
So this thing here, you know, you vary the metric, right? The metric is symmetric. The perturbation of the metric better be symmetric as well. So that's why this nabla mu psi nu symmetrized. You will prove it in your tutorial, that this is precisely the formula. But now what I'm saying is that, well, I define my t mu nu to be symmetric. Okay, so now I'm reverting the logic. T mu nu is symmetric already. So I don't need this symmetrization over here, because if I had some antisymmetric part, it wouldn't do anything, because it would be symmetric times antisymmetric is 0. So I can only take the symmetric part, but you know, this is already symmetric. Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, very good. So far, everybody happy with this thing here? So I have the boundary term, but psi here, the field which I started with doing the coordinate transformation is arbitrary. Psi is arbitrary. Psi is arbitrary. Of course, the boundary term will also contain psi, right? But I can be clever. I can design psi that, you know, psi is something very, very non-trivial inside, in the bulk, but it is 0 on the boundary. So then this boundary term will automatically vanish. So psi on the boundary is equal to 0. You can arrange that. Why not? But if I have arbitrary psi and this is equal to 0, the only possibility is that this thing here has to be equal to 0. So we just proved that on shell and for diffeomorphism invariant theories, you get equation like this. Okay, so such energy momentum tensor defined over here is simply conserved for diffeomorphism invariant theories. Yeah.
theories which are not deterministic?
Yes, you can write some form of the invariant. So you just maybe you just put some fields which look like normal fields, put some vector field there. But now you say this is actually fixed in the background. I don't allow it to change on the coordinate transformation, something like that, right? So then you break the film of some invariance. So it's like whenever people consider like fixed background fields, you break the film of some invariance. And there are such theories. People do that, and it's basically like this revival of ether theories. So Einstein, you know, didn't like ether, so that's why he formulated special relativity. but now actually there's a revival that maybe there's actually ether violating Lorentz invariance and stuff like that. Okay. Very good. So we have this equation, and so now you see that this equation really goes like an equation. You start here and you end up over there. So in some sense, this thing here, the fact that nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero, you are really getting from the diffeomorphism invariance, but also from the fact that the equations for matter are satisfied. So which makes you make a conjecture that maybe this is something like delta phi sm equals to zero. So maybe it is something like equation of motion. That might be our conjecture, right? Because this is an equation. Well, we get this equation provided that this is true. So maybe this nabla mu t mu nu equal to zero, although it's called conservation of energy momentum tensor, maybe it's a little bit more than conservation of energy. Maybe it's actually the equation of motion. Okay. So far, just a conjecture. So by the way, there are these beautiful formulas which we will now use, which you derived in your tutorial, how to vary things, right? So you see that when we calculate t mu nu, we have to vary with respect to the metric, and you derive two beautiful formulas how you vary things. So for example, if you vary the square root of the determinant, then you get things like this. So that's one formula which is helpful. So this is helpful for practical calculations. Is this expression over here? And we had the other one that delta g mu nu with the index downstairs is that you lower the index with a minus sign, g mu rho g nu sigma delta g rho sigma. That was the other formula which you derived in your tutorial. These are very, very useful formulas when you actually do practical calculations when you vary things. Okay, questions? Isn't this beautiful? It's really beautiful, right? So let's have an example, right? So an example would be scale a field. So let's just consider a scalar field with an arbitrary potential. So our action now will be given by d4x square root of minus g, and then the Lagrangian. And so for special relativity, it's 1 half partial phi square. By the way, with my signature, it's minus 1 half. But partial phi square, let's use covariant derivatives, so it will be actually nabla mu phi, nabla nu phi. But then there will be a flat metric, which we are replacing with the curve metric, so it will be curve metric here. So this is the generalization of the kinetic term for free scalar field. But you can also have a potential v of phi, and so that's the Lagrangian which you are interested in. And of course, this is your Lagrangian density. So very good. So now we want our equations of motion. So we can use these Euler-Lagrange equations, which are over there. So dl over d phi. Okay, so this thing here, so there's derivatives of phi here. So the only phi which appears here is this. So we have dl over d phi is actually dv over d phi. So we have minus dv over. So first, equations of motion. Okay, using the Lagrange equations there. So dl over d phi is minus dv over d phi. And then we have minus, okay, let me put a different index, nabla alpha, dl m over d alpha phi. Okay, so that's your Euler-Lagrange equation. And okay, so if we differentiate L with respect to the covariant derivative with respect to the alpha, well, it's here and it's here, and the terms are the same. So it will be 2 times, and I differentiate with respect to 1. So it will be minus, so this is minus dv over d phi. And then this thing here will be minus g. And then when you differentiate nabla mu phi divided by nabla phi, alpha phi, you just get delta mu alpha. So I'm just changing this mu here to alpha. Alpha nu, nabla nu phi. And then if you differentiate, okay, so what is this thing doing here? It's just rising the index to alpha here. And then I differentiate again with respect to alpha, which gives me box operator in curve space, or nabla square in curve space. And there's a minus sign, and there's a minus sign, so it's plus. And that's your equation of motion. Everybody happy? So this is our equation of motion. And of course, you can recover your favorite Klein-Gordon equation by just saying that my potential is just m squared phi squared, and then, well, 1/2. And then if you do dv over d phi, it just gives you m squared phi, and it gives you back box minus m squared acting on phi is equal to 0. Would be a special case of that. Right? That would be your favorite Klein-Gordon equation, which everybody likes. Okay, so that's equation of motion. So second, let's find T mu nu. Very good. So for that, I need to differentiate with respect to the metric. So I'm doing delta G on S. So where is my metric here? So the metric appears over here in the square root of minus g, and it appears over here. Okay? Anywhere else is just phi. Okay, so what I have to do is that I have to differentiate the square root of g. So this will be d4 of x now delta of square root of minus g. And then I leave the method Lagrangian as it was, plus, now I leave this thing here and differentiate the Lagrangian. By differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to delta g mu nu is very simple. I just put a delta in front of this thing here. Okay, so it'll be minus 1/2, nabla mu phi, nabla nu phi, delta g mu nu. This is how I varied the Lagrangian, method Lagrangian, is I just put delta in front of this guy, and the rest is done, and the g does not appear here, so this is what it is. Okay? But I have a beautiful formula for calculating what delta of square root of minus g is. It's this formula over here. Okay? So this is -1/2 square root of minus g, g mu nu, delta g mu nu. Right, just using the formula just above. And hence, I can collect all the results. So there's a -1/2, there's a -1/2. Let's put it in front. And then what we have from here is G mu nu L matter. That's from the first term. And from the second term, we have nabla mu nabla nu phi. Okay. And by definition, if you compare with whatever how we define the T mu nu, this is precisely the T mu nu for the scalar field in curved space. And then if you take the flat space limit of this, you will see that this is precisely what you derived by using the, you know, the canonical approach in special relativity. Okay, so this is our T mu nu. Everybody happy? So we have found T mu nu. That's good. So now, finally, let us look at what if we impose nabla mu T mu nu equals to 0, what do we get as an equation? What does it mean that nabla mu T mu nu equals to 0? So we have one statement which you already verified in special relativity or whatever. You verify that if the equation of motion is satisfied, then this T mu nu will be conserved. That you already know. Okay, let's now ask the other question. If nabla mu T mu nu is equal to 0, what kind of equation will we get for phi? Okay, let's see what do we get, right? So let me raise the index here. So I'm just writing the index g mu nu here. I'm raising it up. Why not? Right? That's what I want to. So now if I do nabla acting on this thing, nabla on g is always equal to 0. Metricity is equal to 0. So this will just be, the first term will be just g mu nu. And then we are doing nabla mu on L matter. That comes from the first term. And then we have to act this nabla mu on the second term. So, but it's a product of two terms. So we have to do, again, Leibniz rule. We have to act on this one, and then we have to act on that one. So then there will be a term plus nabla square on phi, which is nabla mu on phi is nabla square on phi, nabla nu phi, and then plus nabla mu on phi, nabla mu, nabla nu on phi. That's the second term. Okay, so this is what nabla mu T mu nu is. And you require that this is equal to 0. Okay, well, this looks messy. But we haven't calculated what this nabla mu on Lm is, right? So let's calculate what nabla mu on Lm is. Well, Lm is this horrible thing over here. Okay, so we have to, again, change the indices so that, you know, these are just dummy indices. It's not the same index mu as over there. So let's rename these to alpha beta for the moment. And let's try to differentiate with respect to nabla mu. Okay? So again, if nabla mu is hitting the metric here, doesn't do anything, the metricity is 0. So then nabla mu can act on this, it can act on that, it can also act on that. Okay? So this is equal to minus 1/2 G alpha beta lambda mu on lambda alpha phi lambda beta phi. But again, the object is symmetric. In, you know, this is the same thing as this thing. So it's two times, okay? It's two times. So it's like that. And then we have to do minus, and we have to do nabla mu on v, right? But v depends on phi. So how do we do that? We differentiate with respect to phi, and then we differentiate phi. So it's minus dv over d phi, nabla mu phi. That's how we calculate the second term. Okay, so let's now put everything together and let's see if we can get anything useful from here. Okay, first of all, this index alpha here, interesting. So this index alpha here is a stupid index. We can change it to whatever we want. What is it we want? We probably want, well, okay, let's put it there. So we have nabla, g mu nu acting on this thing here. So it's g alpha beta. And then we're just raising the index mu into nu. So it's g nu g alpha phi. That's what comes from the first term. And then it's minus dv over d phi nabla nu phi. And we still have, yeah, that's it. Something very, very strange here. Mu nu g alpha beta. Oh, I forgot beta. Sorry, I forgot the second term. It's also this term here. So it's nabla alpha phi nabla nu nabla alpha phi. That's right, and nabla beta phi. Sorry, I forgot that term. And then it's minus dv over d phi. And then we just write index over there, nabla nu phi. I knew that I shouldn't be doing this calculation. Anyway, so that's this term here. Very good. So now let's write the other terms as well. So it's plus nabla square phi, nabla nu phi, plus nabla mu phi, nabla mu, nabla nu phi, and this is equal to 0. Okay. And now let's see if we can actually cancel some of the terms, and it doesn't seem so, and I don't know why is that. Oh, I forgot minus sign as well. There's a minus sign here. Sorry for that. So there's a minus sign. So now this is alpha beta, so it basically raises one of these indices here. Let's put it beta here. And let's forget about that thing here. And okay, so we have nabla beta phi, and there's nabla beta phi. But there's also this term, which is nabla mu phi, nabla mu phi. Okay, one comes with a minus sign. One comes with a plus sign. So let's try to bring them as close together as we can. So if the terms are to look roughly the same, I lower this index, I raise this index, and call it mu. Okay? So this thing here is just minus nabla nu, nabla mu phi, nabla mu phi. Okay? Yes?
Shouldn't it be canceling that with the third term? With the nabla squared phi,
So nabla square means means nabla mu, nabla mu.
Sorry, yeah.
So there must be a same index, right? So what I want to compare it is this term over here.
Okay.
So we have nabla nu, nabla mu, and then nabla mu phi. So nabla mu phi is the same. So this thing here is the same as this thing here. So then I have nabla mu, nabla nu, minus nabla nu, nabla mu. Okay. It's a commutator of the covariant derivatives, but it's a commutator of the covariant derivative acting on a scalar. Okay. That is zero. Okay, if you have commutator of the derivative acting on a scalar, it's zero. If it acts on a vector, it gives you the Riemann tensor. But if it acts on a scalar, it's zero. So basically what I'm saying is that this term cancels that term over here. Okay, so what do we have left? We have that nabla nu phi times nabla square phi minus dv over d phi equals to zero. Sorry for my messy calculation, but certainly the result is correct. So now look at that beauty here, right? If we are imposing that nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero, well, we have two possibilities: either nabla nu phi is zero, or this is zero. If phi is not degenerate, meaning if it's not like super, if it's not constant, right? This will not be zero. So then this has to be zero. So if phi non-degenerate, or not special, let's say, if phi not very special, then what we have just shown is that nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero implies equation of motion. So it seems that our conjecture may almost be true, right? What we require is that, you know, the nabla on phi is not equal to zero. It can be for very special cases. If I have constant phi, this will be zero, and then I cannot derive equations of motion from requiring that the energy momentum tensor is conserved. But for more generic situations, this will be the case, right? We already know that this is true. So this is always true. That's what you have been doing so far in your special relativity course or in quantum field theory course. If the equations of motion are satisfied, then energy momentum tensor is conserved. Okay? That you have been doing all the time. So this is always true. But now we have shown that the converse is almost always true, unless you have special phi. Okay? So let me conjecture even more strongly now that the conservation of the energy momentum tensor is equivalent to the equations of motion up to some very special cases. Okay. So now you were showing your tutorial again. Is that so? We have been doing the scalar field theory, and you see that I already messed up a little bit. Never do calculations more than three lines on the blackboard. So you will study Maxwell theory in your tutorial. You know that the equations of motion for Maxwell theory are Maxwell equations, right? So namely nabla mu. So in Maxwell, which you will do in tutorial, is that you know that these are the equations of motion. J nu or something like that. These are the equations of motion for Maxwell field. I will give you the Lagrangian from where you can derive the equations of motion like this, right? You can derive what the energy momentum tensor is. You will see that the derivation is again two line. It's very simple. You will find that that's the right energy momentum tensor, which is already symmetric and so on. So it's the improved canonical energy momentum tensor for Maxwell field. Okay, and then what you will find is that if you require this thing here is equal to zero, then you will see that it almost gives you this up to something that actually you now contract this equation. So you will have something like nabla mu f mu nu, and then this will be contracted with f nu alpha is equal to j nu f nu alpha. this is what you get from here. Okay. So now this looks almost like the equations of motion which we want, except now you have to be able to get rid of this f nu alpha. You can get rid of the f nu alpha if f nu alpha is a matrix, has an inverse. So if you can invert this, then I can multiply by inverse f nu alpha here, and I can get equations of motion. So for non-degenerate electromagnetic field, meaning the f nu nu has full matrix rank, you will be you can show that nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero exactly gives you the equations of motion, Maxwell equations. Okay, so if non-degenerate, again, if f mu alpha has inverse, meaning it is non-degenerate, then this is equations of motion, Maxwell equations. Okay. So what I'm trying to say really here is that you shouldn't be thinking about the conservation of energy momentum tensor as conservation of energy. It is stronger than that. It is actually almost the equations of motion. In fact, for non-degenerate cases, it is precisely equations of motion. Questions? Yes.
So is this just like F equals ma in disguise, in the sense that like the ma part is like b dot, and we are very specific tensor, which is like momentum.
Oh, very good. So I don't know F equal to ma, but let's take an action for a point particle. Okay. So then you can write down what the action for the point particle is. We know what it is. You can write down what the corresponding energy momentum tensor for the particle is. You can impose nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero for the particle. What do you get? Geodesic equation. Okay, nabla mu t mu nu for the particle, for the energy momentum tensor of the particle, gives you the geodesic equation, which gives you, in special case, the Newton's law. Try it. Okay, try to derive geodesic equation from requiring the nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero for the particle. All right, so now there's this pointless exercise. Who has seen Navier-Stokes equations? Okay, should we derive them in general relativity? We don't need to. Who wants to see Navier-Stokes equations in general relativity? Oh no, okay. Let's do it. Okay, so it's again painful calculation. So let's consider perfect fluid. Okay. And so what I'm giving you, and actually, you know, okay, is the energy momentum tensor for the perfect fluid. So the energy momentum tensor for the perfect fluid is just the fluid density plus the pressure in the rest frame. So this is the energy density in the rest frame of the fluid. This is the pressure in the rest frame of the fluid. And then u mu is the tangent vector of how the fluid flows, plus p g mu nu. Okay? So basically, we have a situation like this, where these are the, you know, basically how the fluid is flowing here. So that's the tangent vector for the fluid. And this is the energy density, and this is the pressure. Energy density and that's the pressure. And this is how the energy momentum tensor looks like. And this is precisely the thing which you will be using in cosmology. We'll be saying, well, actually, our universe is filled with, you know, fluid, which, you know, how you describe galaxies and everything, like, you know, fluid. In fact, you typically set, yeah. Okay, so this is a useful energy momentum tensor. So now let's see again what nabla mu t mu nu give us, right? So we again are asking, what happens when we do nabla mu t mu nu equal to zero, you know, what do we get? And before we go into that calculation, it is useful to play with projectors, okay? So if I have the fluid flowing like this, okay, and this is my tangent vector at that point, u mu, that you can decompose your space-time into the space which is parallel to your tangent vector u mu and which is perpendicular to that vector. So we have like parallel space, so this would be like a parallel space. And then you have a perpendicular space here. So that's the perpendicular space. So now, how do you project things into parallel space and into perpendicular? So projector to parallel space. Okay. So projector, what it has to give us. So if I want to project something so that it preserves anything which is parallel to u mu, it better preserves u mu as well, right? So any ideas how this projector to parallel space along u mu could look like? I can use u mu to construct it, or I can use the metric to construct it, or I can use other objects. So would you know how the projector which is parallel to u mu would look like? So if I apply it, so projector is something which is a matrix with two indices, projector p alpha beta, when I apply on u, it has to give me u back. Any ideas what this projector could look like? So p parallel alpha beta. So remember here, I'll help you, is that, you know, all, so this is like a velocity of the fluid, but of course the velocity of the fluid satisfies u squared is minus one. Okay, so maybe, what if I use something like u, u? Would that work? If I have p alpha beta, the first table would be like, why don't we do u alpha, u beta? If we do this, what happens when I apply it? So now p alpha beta parallel on u beta, what would that give me? It will give me u alpha, u beta, so this is u square, that's minus one. It gives me minus u alpha. So it's almost good, apart from the minus sign. So if I put a minus sign here, it will be a minus sign here, it will be a plus sign here, and this is what I want. Okay, so the projector, which is parallel to my tangent vector, is precisely u alpha u beta with a minus sign. Okay, so then, of course, if this is to be a projector, it also must satisfy p alpha beta, p beta gamma, is the same projector. If you project twice, it gives you the same thing, alpha, gamma, and you can check that this is true. Okay. So then, how does the projector to the perpendicular space look like? So projector to perpendicular space. Any ideas? Think about the composition of unity. Okay, if I have identical map, and it can split into perpendicular pieces, the perpendicular projections. So if I project here, plus projection over there has to give me unity, right? So it's okay. So H alpha, P alpha beta perpendicular is just unit alpha beta minus P alpha beta. Right? Projector to this plus projector to that gives me unity. Okay, if I write it in GR notation, so one is just delta alpha beta, and this is that, so it's minus minus, so it's plus u alpha u beta. Everybody happy with these projectors? And again, you can check that the projector square, it gives you the same thing. Okay? So we have, you know, two orthogonal projections, one along the velocity direction and one perpendicular to the velocity direction. Okay. So horrible calculation now. Let's calculate what nabla mu t mu nu is equal to and set it equal to 0. Okay? So we have 0 equals to nabla mu t mu nu. And let's do what this nabla mu t mu nu is. Okay? So we have to differentiate many terms. So we have rho plus p partial mu when we differentiate the first one and using the fact that this is a scalar. U mu. We differentiate the first term. Then we differentiate the second term. So you have rho plus p nabla mu u mu u nu plus rho plus p u mu nabla mu u nu plus p mu g mu nu plus 0 here. So I differentiate all the terms here with nabla mu. Okay, so this is how this thing looks like. It's not very, very illuminating, right? So that's an equation which has to be true. But you know, what does it mean? I don't know. Okay, at this point. Well, that's the equation. So why don't I take this equation and project it to the space which is parallel with my velocity and which is perpendicular to the velocity? Let's see what do I get. Okay, so first project parallel to u mu. Okay, which means I multiply it by u alpha, well, okay, so what I'm doing here is just that I'm doing p alpha nu parallel nabla mu t mu nu. Okay, so I'm taking this equation here, it has an index nu, and I'm projecting that index nu parallel to my velocity. This has to be equal to 0. And from what I have over there, it's minus u alpha u nu nabla mu t mu nu. OK. Everybody happy? Tough calculation, OK? Of calculation. Okay. So this is 0. U alpha is not 0 because we have flowing fluid. It may be, well, it's typically non-zero. Okay? So I can forget about the minus and about the u alpha. So I have 0 is equal to u nu nabla mu t mu nu. Okay? Very good. So what it means is that I basically have to take this equation here and multiply it by u nu. What do I get? What do I get from the first term? Right? I have this thing here multiplied by u nu. I'll have this thing here, and then I'll have u nu, that gives me minus 1. So the first term will be minus rho plus p mu u mu. That's the first term. What about the second term? Again, I will have u nu, and I can combine it with this u nu. It gives me minus 1. This will be minus rho plus p nabla mu u mu. Okay. Then what about the third term here? I will have u nu, okay, so what I get for the third term is that I have u nu, nabla mu, u nu. Do you know what that is? Huh? Somebody? U square is minus one. What is this thing here? It's zero because I am differentiating u square, right? I'm differentiating u square with respect to nabla mu. It's minus one, it's equal to zero. Mm-hmm. Very good. So if I look at this term here, it's zero. It's plus zero. And finally, I have a term plus u nu, the last term. And this is like p partial nu, which is over here. Okay, so this is what I get. So now look at this. This term here, p partial mu u mu. And I have this term here, u nu partial p partial nu. They have the same terms, except that one is denoted by nu and the other one is denoted by mu. All right, so this term here cancels this term here. It's the same term. Okay, and so I have a result. And the result is, so I have rho divided by mu, u mu. The directional derivative of the density with respect to u mu. If I parameterize my u mu by some parameter tau, what this really is d rho over d tau. Okay, so this is a d rho over d tau, which is this term here, plus rho plus p. Divergence of u is equal to zero. What is this equation here?
Continuity.
It's a continuity equation, as you know it from fluid mechanics. Okay, so you just shown this is a continuity equation. And yeah, it's some kind of conservation, I don't know, something. Whatever flows in, whatever flows out. the same thing flows out. So this is a continuity equation. So the projection of the nabla mu t mu equals to zero into the space parallel with the velocity gives you continuity equation. That's beautiful, right? So basically what we have done is that we just project it along the vector field u. So we just use one component of this conservation of the energy momentum tensor. We just project it along u nu. What about the other three components? The other three components we get by projecting perpendicular direction. OK, so second, project perpendicular to u mu. You get zero because it's a projector to the perpendicular space. So if you project this term here, because you had this u nu here, you get zero. Okay. What about the second term? It's also zero because I also hit this u nu. Okay, here I may have something non-trivial, so let's write it. Rho plus p u nu nabla mu. And then I will have u nu. And this is projected by this thing over here, which is delta alpha nu plus u alpha u nu. OK, so that's the projector here. So that's what the third term gives us. What about the last term? The last term gives us again, there was a projector P alpha nu perpendicular on this P partial nu. Okay. So that is a gradient of the pressure here. But now I'm projecting the gradient of the pressure to the perpendicular space. So I have perpendicular gradient of the pressure. Let's call this just P perpendicular. Nabla P alpha perpendicular. Why not? So it's just a perpendicular pressure. Okay. So that's this term. We have only one more term to deal with, but I wrote it. I decomposed what the projector is here. Right? What happens when I have this part of the projector? So I have u nu multiplied by the rest here, but I have nabla mu acting on u nu times u nu. What is that? Well, it's zero because it's again like a derivative of u square. So this term does not contribute. Okay, so the only thing which I have here is this term, and it just changes the index nu to alpha. Okay, so this will just be alpha. And that's it. So then I have a beautiful equation, which is that rho plus p times u mu nabla mu on u alpha is equal to minus gradient alpha p perpendicular. Okay. So now, if you have ever seen Navier-Stokes equations, this is the relativistic generalization. Okay, so this is what is Navier-Stokes equation. So now, if you want non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equation, but really, what I am not putting here is, again, the units of c, the velocity of light. So what turns out is that whenever you see p here, it's sort of like p over c square. So it's rho plus p over c square. So this term here would be negligible. And then you really have like rho times this covariant derivative of u, the acceleration, is given by the pressure, which is very intuitive, right? So if you act with a pressure on thing, that's what causes the fluid to move. Okay, so this is very intuitive Navier-Stokes equation.
Isn't it like the Euler equation because we don't have like viscosity?
That's right. Yeah. So here we have perfect fluid, so it's Navier-Stokes equation for perfect fluid, right? So yeah, you would need to modify your energy momentum tensor, which is somewhere here. So yes, you can start upgrading this energy momentum tensor for higher derivative terms, and then you can have viscosity and you can have other things, right? Yeah, and it's doable, and you can do it, and then you will have Navier-Stokes equation with viscosity if you want. So in other words, what I just showed you by this long and annoying calculation is that nabla mu t mu equals to zero contains information about both. It contains information about the continuity equation, but it also contains information about the equation of motion. Okay, so again, it knows about everything. Just remember this for the rest of your life. Nabla mu t mu equals to zero gives you both. It gives you continuity equation, it gives you the equation of motion. It gives you the equation of motion. It's more than conservation of energy. It's actually equation of motion. Okay? So happy smile. That's a sum, okay? Let's take 3-minute break. Yes.
What do you mean? Can you explain what you mean by non-degenerate more precisely? Especially for the scaling.
It depends on the situation, right? So really, what I was trying to say, for example, is the Maxwell field here. So you get really something that is multiplied by f,
yeah.
Right? And in order to recover the full equations, I have to be invert.
Yeah.
F. So really, it means f has to have full rank, and it has to be non-negative, and I must be able to write the inverse of f. So here, for the scalar field, what it simply meant is that phi is not a scale, is not a constant, right? If phi is a constant here, then this could be zero.
Oh right.
Right, and in that case, you know, of course, constant phi will also satisfy this.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So things like this, you have to study case by case, I think. To really say what the precise conditions are.
Yes.
But if you have like the generic situation where nothing is really, really special, then it's equivalent.
Yeah. Thanks.
Or maybe we can leave this thing here.
David?
Yes?
Can you remind us why u squared equals minus one?
Sure.
Oh, so this is just the definition. Like, so similarly to... You can show it's equal to constant. And you always normalize the constant to minus one or something like that. It's the same like with the particle, right? So if I parameterize the particle with the proper time, then u squared will be minus one. If I use some other parameter, it may be something else, but I can always reparameterize to put it minus one. So it's like, yeah, I am like parameterizing my flow with the right parameter so that u squared is minus one. More questions, please.
I've seen like what is so fundamental about TMU that it gives us like conversion of this quantity gives us the equation of motion.
Uh-huh.
Just define it here as you vary the action.
Uh-huh.
And there was like, I'm not like convinced why this is a very important physical.
Well, what do you mean it's not very important? So first of all, what I've shown is that it is symmetric. Symmetric.
Just using this conservation, which is delta mu, mu nu equal to zero, we get random equations of motions. So it seems like an important thing to me. Right?
It is important.
But when you define it, you just
exactly. So exactly. So when you define it, you know. So this like somebody very clever came up with this definition, right? So but you know, once you make the definition, you see like far-reaching consequences, and you will see even more. Like right. So. Wait. You will see it next lecture, right? So what this really, how powerful this really is, right? Wait. Okay. Everybody back here. So very good. So now we understand everything we need to know about matter in curved space, right? So the last thing which we need to do is to construct the action principle for the gravity itself, right? So we want now to write down the action from where, you know, the gravitational field equations follow, okay? And so how do we do that, right? So typically, what you would be looking for is that you look for a Lagrangian which would depend on the metric and on the first derivatives of the metric. And if you have, you know, Lagrangian like this, then by writing the Euler-Lagrange equations for this, well, because you have the field and the first derivative, you will get second order second order Euler Lagrange equations for the metric, right? And so that would be perfect, right? If we can write such a Lagrangian, which is a scalar, which depends on the metric and the partial derivatives of the metric, and if I write down the Euler Lagrange equations, I can get second order equations of motion for the metric, and that's precisely what I'm probably looking for, right? The question is, can we write Lagrangian, which would be a scalar, which depends on the metric and the first derivative of the metric? What do you think? Any suggestions? So, which object contained first derivatives of the metric? It's the Christoffel symbol. Is it a tensor? What can I do with the Christoffel symbol? If I go to the freely falling frame, I can always arrange that the Christoffel symbol vanishes, that the first derivatives vanish, right? So actually, by going to the freely falling frame, I can always kill this first derivative here. Okay, then I have a Lagrangian, which is function of g only. Well, that doesn't give me second order Euler Lagrange equations. I need really the first derivatives to be there. So there does not exist any such scalar, because everything, you know, you have proved it in the principle of equivalence. There is nothing which I could construct out of this which would preserve the first derivatives under the operation going to the freely falling frame. So this does not exist. Okay, so that's a betrayal here. So you cannot write a scalar. So what you want is the scalar Lagrangian, right? True scalar, which would depend on the metric and the first derivative of the metric, and there is no such scalar. You cannot do that because always by going freely falling frame, you can delete the first derivatives of the metric, and hence this will not give you second order equations, but it give you only first order equations. So then you have two possibilities. You relax on the fact that your Lagrangian is a scalar, and some people go that way, and you get something which is called Einstein action. Or you want to preserve that the Lagrangian is a scalar, which is precisely what you would like to do, right? Why to give up the homomorphism invariants? But then the best you can do is that you also include second derivatives of the metric. Okay, so we have two possibilities. Give up the Diffeo invariants, and you get so-called Einstein action, but it's not interesting. Or you demand scalar. But the best you can do is that now your Lagrangian depends on the metric, on the first derivative of the metric, and on the second derivative of the metric. So now we know that if we include second derivatives of the metric, we cannot delete those by going to the freely falling frame. They are precisely captured by the Riemann tensor. So then the question is, what kind of scalar I can construct out of the Riemann tensor? Any ideas?
Ricci scalar.
So then, you know, basically uniquely, let the setting that the Lagrangian for gravity better be something like the Ricci scalar. Indeed, this is the case. And then this is what was found by Hilbert first, because he scooped Einstein, but it's now called Einstein-Hilbert action, because of course Hilbert was influenced by Einstein, who gave a seminar about what he's looking for. And then Hilbert did it first, but anyway. And this is given, so why not? 16 pi g is the gravitational Newton constant. And then ddx square root of minus g, the Ricci scalar, which is a function of the metric, first derivative of the metric, and second derivative of the metric. Okay. And so this is the Einstein-Hilbert action. And you see that you don't really have many other possibilities here, just, you know, by going doing this argument. So this is what I want, but unfortunately it doesn't exist. So either I give up diffeomorphism invariants and write something of this type, but it will not be a scalar, or I demand a scalar, but the best I can do is that I also include the second derivatives, and then you are basically uniquely led to the to the Ricci scale. Okay, so this is the action for gravity. Very good. So we have the action, and we understand this action as a function. So this is a the field is g mu nu, right? So now, in order to derive the corresponding equations of motion, we vary with respect to the g mu nu. But there is one important trick, which, okay, let me show you. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to vary this action with respect to the corresponding field, which is our metric, so delta g of Einstein-Hilbert. And this will be 1 over 16 pi g d dx. And then I will use a trick. Let me use the trick. So we have to vary the metric. But the metric is in this minus 1 over square root of g in this thing here. And then I write my Ricci scalar as a Ricci tensor times the metric. Why not? So this is equal to g mu nu r mu nu. Right, this is what I have to do. Oh no, did I delete my beautiful formula for delta square root of g? I probably did, right? Ah, wrong choice. Anyway, so this is how you vary the action. So now you have to vary this, you have to vary that, and you have to vary that. Right? So you have three terms which you have to vary. Okay, let's do it. So this is 1 over 16 pi g d dx. Now, the simplest thing which I vary is this g mu nu. I just put delta in front of it. Right, so the square root of g. Square root of minus g r mu nu delta g mu nu. Okay, so I varied this thing here. That was simple. Yes?
Sorry, why is this considered like a dirty trick?
Oh, well, it's not a dirty trick. Well, it's true, right? It's definitely true. This is the Ricci scale how we defined it.
Right.
Okay.
In the notes it says.
Yeah. Sorry. So it is true. It is true. It's very clever to do it this way, but I haven't explained why. But I will explain in a minute, right? But this is still, there's nothing strange about this. I just write it Ricci scale as g mu nu r mu nu, right? Okay, very good. So if I differentiate this term here, that's very simple. Then I have to differentiate this term here. That's also simple. That's given by the formula which I deleted. Okay, so then it's minus 1/2 square root of minus g. G mu nu, well, okay. Let's write it this way. G mu nu delta G mu nu. So that's how or what you get when you differentiate the determinant. But I still have this thing here, which I'm not touching now. But it's, again, back to the Ricci scale times R. Right? So then I differentiated this term here. So this is 1, this is 2. So finally, it seems I need to differentiate the third term. Okay, the third term seems very difficult, right? I have to vary r mu nu. R mu nu depends on the Christoffels. They depend on the metric. I have to vary all that, right? Let's just write it plus square root of minus g, g mu nu, delta r mu nu. Okay? So these are the three terms which I have to do. Okay. The third one is the most difficult one. Let's do it at the end. What do I get by combining these two terms over here? Okay? So this thing here is 1 over 16 pi g d dx, and then I have square root of g is here, And then I have r mu nu from the first term. And then I have minus 1 half r g mu nu delta g mu nu. Plus the last term, plus 1 over 16 pi g integral ddx square root of minus g g mu nu delta r mu nu. Can anybody see something beautiful? So what is the what is this first bracket here? That's the definition of the Einstein tensor. Now you already know how the Einstein equations look like. They are, in the absence of matter, chi mu nu equals to zero. Well, of course, this is a variational principle. I want to set this equal to zero, right? So already the first two terms, where I didn't have to do anything really, I just differentiate the square root of g and I put delta in front of chi mu nu. Right, give me the right Einstein equation, g mu nu equals to zero, in the absence of matter. Right, so we have, already this is g mu nu, and it seems like I'm getting the Einstein equation just from the first two terms. This is indeed true. You're getting the Einstein equations just from the first two terms. So why the hell this thing here does not contribute? What do you think? Listen. The third term, if it gives something non-trivial, it will spoil my Einstein equations. The statement is, you don't need to do the variation of the third term. You don't need to do the painful calculation. And the reason for that is that it can be shown that the last term is just a boundary term. Okay? This is a boundary term. I will write what this boundary term looks like for you. So the boundary term simply looks like, so it can be shown that g mu nu delta r mu nu is equal to nabla mu v mu. It's a total derivative where this nabla mu, where this v mu is equal to nabla beta delta what? Chi mu beta minus g alpha beta nabla mu delta g alpha beta. Okay? So this is a painful calculation that can be done, but let's not be bothered by that. What is important is that the third term really gives you just a total divergence, and you can turn it into a boundary term. And so it doesn't contribute to the equations of motion. So it's a boundary term. That does not contribute to Einstein equations. Okay? And so we are done. By imposing the action principle, by setting this equal to zero, your boundary term, you throw it away, as we always do. And then we have the Einstein equations we just derived, vacuum Einstein equation, which is g mu nu equals to zero from here. Okay? So that's the vacuum Einstein equation in the absence of matter. Isn't this easy peasy? Just derived thing. Except we haven't done really the hard work to show that the last term is a boundary term, but it can be shown. It's a couple of lines calculation. Okay? So if we throw away the boundary term, and we are happy. However, this looks nice. So we have vacuum Einstein equations. Typically, people like to use, you know, fixed boundary value problem, right? So you fix something on the boundary, you vary it in the bulk, and that's how you get equations of motion. And if you fix something on the boundary term vanishes, right? Or in the field theory case, it's a Dirichlet boundary condition. You fix the field on the boundary, and that's it. So now, this thing is the thing which is on the boundary. Is it Dirichlet boundary condition? In other words, I would have to be imposing that delta g alpha beta on the boundary is equal to 0. OK, is this true? Is this a traditional Dirichlet boundary condition? No, it's not, because I have derivatives of that, right? It looks more like a Neumann boundary condition. I'm taking a derivative of the boundary data, and that imposing it to 0. So this is not Dirichlet boundary value problem. So it's a little bit weird boundary value problem. You need to be imposing this is equal to this vanishes on the boundary, right? So that you have well-defined variational principle, but that's not a Dirichlet boundary value problem because you have the derivatives there. You have derivatives acting on delta. It's more like Neumann boundary value problem. Okay. So if you want Dirichlet boundary value problem, this is not the right action. You need to add a boundary term which kills this term here, but instead imposes something that if I impose just delta GAB fixed on the boundary is equal to 0, then so if we want Dirichlet boundary problem, we need to upgrade. We need to add a boundary term to the action. Then you have to consider S Einstein-Hilbert plus something which is an integral over the boundary. And what stands over there is the extrinsic k, which is scalar. Okay, so whatever that is. So this is the right action for the Dirichlet boundary problem. This term here is incorrectly called Gibbons-Hawking term because it was York who was the first one to discover it. So let's call it York Gibbons-Hawking term. Okay, and so the right action, if you want really Dirichlet boundary value problem for gravity, it's not just the Einstein-Hilbert action, but you have to add d3x square root of h. H is the metric on the boundary. So this is determinant of the metric on the boundary, so that this is a scalar again. And this is a scalar quantity there. OK, this is called extrinsic curvature. Extrinsic curvature. And only if you add this term here, this term precisely cancels, you know, this mass over here and imposes the standard thing something times delta GAB on the boundary. And if you impose delta GAB on the boundary without derivatives is equal to 0, then you get the standard Dirichlet boundary value problem. So this is the right action. Okay. Questions? So the last remark I want to have is that you have g mu nu equal to 0. That's your vacuum Einstein equation. That's how, if you write it this way, you can never make a mistake. But what is this? This is r mu nu minus 1/2 r g mu nu equals to 0. Okay, so that's what the vacuum Einstein equation is. What happens if I trace it with the metric? So I multiply by g mu nu. What do I get from the first term? Which is scalar, right? Minus 1/2. And then you have g mu nu. What is that? It's a trace of the unit matrix. So if you are in D dimensions, you get D. Okay, it's equal to 0. Very good. So if D is not equal to 2, then this equation implies that R has to be equal to 0. So if D is not equal to 2, then the Ricci scale has to be equal to 0 in vacuum spacetimes. Okay? But if I plug it back here, the vacuum Einstein equations then read as R mu nu equals to 0. So you will often see that when people write down the Einstein equations in vacuum, they don't write the full Einstein tensor, but they just write the Ricci tensor equals to 0. Right? And it's right. Both things are right because you can trace this equation and get to a simpler, little bit simpler equation, R mu equals to 0, if you are not in two dimensions. Okay. Okay, very good. So we have Einstein equations, vacuum at least. Well, adding matter is easy peasy. So we will do it next time. And I will tell you some tricks and some interesting consequences of nabla mu t mu nu equals to 0 next time. Questions? Comments? Complaints?
So I have a question about 2D. So yesterday in the tutorial, like, Gazal told me that t mu nu is identically 0 in 2D. So how do I couple matter to...
Well, first of all, you don't have gravity. Like, if you just write down the Einstein-Hilbert action in 2D, what you can show is that this R here, well, the whole thing is just a total derivative. So if you vary it, it's a total derivative. It's a boundary term. You don't get any equations of motion. So what you get is identically equal to 0. So Einstein theory in two dimensions is not the right theory. And so people then, you know, go beyond Einstein if you want. And the simplest thing you can do is that if you want to do two-dimensional Einstein's theory, is that, well, this is topological, it's a total derivative, but if I couple it to a scalar field, you put phi r, right? So although this is a total derivative, nabla mu r mu, well, this is not because the phi is here, right? And so this is the simplest theory you can write down in two dimensions, which has non-trivial degrees of freedom. And you say now you have a scalar tensor theory of gravity in two dimensions. And this will be your theory, right? So in TD, really, if you just write R, it doesn't give you anything. So the Einstein theory, like pure Einstein gravity in two dimensions, is not well defined. But once you couple it to phi, which is what typically people do as the simplest, whatever the model you can have, then you have non-trivial equations of motion. More questions? Everybody's destroyed. No. Okay, yeah?
The exterior curvature is traced with the metrical boundary, right?
Say it again. The
exterior curvature is traced with the metrical boundary, right?
That's right, yeah. So, yeah. So what this extrinsic curvature is, right? So very intuitively, I told you that a cylinder looks locally like a plane, right? I just curl it up. So it doesn't have any intrinsic curvature. The Riemann tensor there will be equal to 0. But then how you would define, well, but this doesn't look not curved, right? It's going like that. It looks curved. So how do you calculate what the extrinsic curvature is? Is that you take the normal of the surface, and if the normal is changing, then your surface has extrinsic curvature. Okay, and the normal is changing. So the cylinder has zero intrinsic curvature. The Riemann tensor is zero because it looks locally like a plane. But because it's curled up, the normal will be changing. And what this thing here is precisely a divergence of the normal. So what the KE here is nabla mu n mu, where the n mu is the normal. And the n mu is changing. So nabla mu n mu will be non-trivial. So this thing here will have non-trivial extrinsic curvature. All right. Yeah.
Can we say that Ricci tensor it describes the curvature due to matter, some the presence of matter, and extrinsic curvature is some curvature that you see from a flat space?
Well, the extrinsic curvature is really like if you sort of embed your manifold into some higher dimensional manifolds, right? So what I'm really plotting here, what I really was showing here is that I was treating the cylinder as a manifold, which lives in my Euclidean space, in the three-dimensional space. Then I know what the normal is, because the normal lives in this higher dimensional space, right? It doesn't live in the cylinder itself. It actually goes out of the cylinder, right? So if you embed manifold into some bigger dimensional manifold, you can start talking about these extrinsic things, right? It's really something that is given from outside for your manifold, right? And